So let's again, let's just harvest some of your insights. What did you come up with some or share some interesting ways in which liturgy and some of the aspects of worship reinforce promising or promising reinforces those parts? What did you share? Or how you connect formal promises like baptism or marriage or ordination to everyday living? What are some,
Oh, well, all the members of our group have are in churches where they've instituted renewal baptism opportunities in worship as part of their kind of spiritual inventory, recommitment to your vows to Christ kind of thing. And at least two of us were doing that as a result of being students here. So,
What does that look like?
Well, in my church setting, we do it around the first of the year, and we use the Presbyterian renewal baptism liturgy, but also include a spiritual inventory opportunity where people can actually look at themselves in depth to say, this is where I'm at, and make a promise to this is where I want to go. And then a year later, they get that card back that they filled out to say, how did you fulfill that promise?
Do they get wet in any way again or no?
Yes.
What I've done is different from that. I've taken since Cyril's catechism and the stages that he followed in baptism and made that into a service of baptismal renewal. You can even see a picture in my thesis on that if you want to put it in the library.
Where I am,
very interesting.
Where I am, we do a service that is based on Presbyterian liturgy that allows for the whole congregation, as many as wish, to come forward and touch the water of baptism.
Cool.
So they're not rebaptized, but they can come and touch the water. And the first year we did it, actually, we thought, well, it's a worshiping congregation of 200 plus people and 260 or something. And we thought, well, you know, will anybody come? And so I encouraged the choir, please go and lead the way. So at least there will be a few people that go and touch the water, you know, and it won't be, the symbolism won't be completely lost. And virtually the entire congregation came the first year. And it's become, immediately became such an important action of telling God's story and doing God's story that we could never not do it again, I don't think.
Interesting. And some churches will take a palm branch, put it in the water, and then just start flinging it too. Yes. You guys do that?
Well, I was going to say, that's the traditional part of the Aspergus is traditional part of the Easter Vigil service, which we do. But when we baptize, we also have a renewal of baptism. But the font is, you know, on the way out every day, and we make that an intentional part of going forward. Mm-hmm. You remember your baptism as you go forward.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cole, I'm just curious, how many of you in your churches require either some type of baptismal class or some type of baptism education before you actually practice baptism, either by sprinkling, immersion, or any? And how many of you that raised your hands are not Southern Baptists? That's what I thought. Because our biggest challenge in Southern Baptist life today is this great disconnect. To be the nation's largest Protestant denomination and yet have the widest disparity between the number of people that claim membership and are attending worship or involved in their congregation on a weekly basis. And I have long believed, and I don't know if my friend who's stepped out for a moment, Mark, would agree, but I've long believed that a misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the baptismal covenant is part of the blame. That our people don't fully understand the significance. Of course, this was all made clear to me in 704. But that our people don't clearly understand the significance of what they are doing and what is required. The promise.
The promises.
And so therefore, we have two major epidemic problems in Southern Baptist life today. We have this huge gap. And we also have a lot of transferring. people moving around from church to church. You've already addressed this, trying to find that perfect, you know, fit. And so I'm just, you know, and our leaders lament this problem, but nobody is willing to really
quite figure out how to address it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Chris, if I remember from 704 well enough, you shared the story of part of the problem being how the pastors will point out the ordinariness of what's taking place. This is just regular tap water. This isn't that big of a deal. You know, so in a sense, rather than speaking of it as a sacrament, it's just spoken of as something as commonplace as brushing your teeth today.
And we rush the process.
Yeah.
You know.
What's more efficient?
I'm not going to be, if I can use Baptist jargon, I'm not going to be less saved because I wait a while to actually participate in the act of baptism so that I fully know what it is. And yet we're so quick to rush these people into the baptismal waters as if they're going to lose their salvation. It's quite...
Well, I think I worked with your pastor. Because when I was in 704, I worked with I was in Southern Baptist context then, and I wished I had a nickel for every time before either communion or baptism we spent 20 minutes for him telling us all about what we're not fixing to do. Mm-hmm. And so my project was to write a baptismal catechesis for the Southern Baptist context and still use it, but modify it for our present context. Mm. So you go, you're important, your work is good.
Well, and I appreciate you helping to provide some clarity to why I get so frustrated.
That's my calling.
I want to say that our discussions in the Ancient Future Faith Network later this week, some of it will focus on Bob's Ancient Future Evangelism book, which speaks directly to that specific issue.
Journey to Jesus as well.
Okay, good. Well, I think one of the things that we're getting at when we talk about the importance of the baptismal vows and the opportunities to repeat them is the key role of sort of telling and retelling our stories. And that's telling the stories of faith, it's telling the stories of the community, and then it's telling individual stories. And they become terribly important for helping us to sort of fix identity. And that becomes important for long-term members, as you're talking about in terms of these reaffirmation of baptismal vows, as well as for newcomers to understand what it is that they're seeing and experiencing. But I think it helps the community itself to stay focused and help people to understand why it is we're doing what we're doing, why things are done in certain ways. Discussions of the vision itself, the meaning of those vows and so on, can be expressions of faithfulness as we recognize sometimes changed circumstances and needs. So when we tell the biblical story, as well as the stories, again, of our traditions or congregations, we're reminded of who we are and to whom we belong. So reaffirming our commitments in the context of an ongoing narrative provides a much fuller context for understanding our activities and choices. And that's true whether it's in the context of communion, Eucharist, or whether it's in the baptismal setting, whether it's in reflections on creeds, sometimes that can really help people kind of locate themselves. Sometimes in new member classes or anniversaries or formation programs, just repeating some of those stories of faith can be important. I think also, and part of this relates also to the significance of the baptismal vows, making our commitments public tends to stabilize them and strengthen promises. Public articulation of commitments is important in sustaining a way of life. The promises that are associated with things like marriage or baptism are difficult for any human being. And it's terribly naive to think we can do it just on our own. I mean, those need to be done in community. And so moments of individual promise making are also reminders then of to the community of their own prior vows and commitments and serve as a way of renewing them, which is exactly what you all were talking about. I think in the Wesleyan tradition, the covenant service that Wesley developed is another, it's absolutely full of the language of promising. But again, lots of times churches in the Wesleyan tradition use that on New Year's Eve to sort of commit to the next, the faithfulness for the next year. I think Also, we can assess the practice of, or we can strengthen the practice of promising by helping people learn to assess the kinds of commitments they should make. This is, again, sort of a formation kind of issue, but sometimes people promise to do things or commit to tasks or programs without counting the cost. And they become habitual promise breakers because they could never do what they said they were going to do. I mean, there's no way that they could fulfill all of the commitments they've made. And I think pastors and leaders could help staff and volunteers, especially, who struggle with this, teaching them to do better assessment up front in terms of the commitments and promises they make. I think we also need to be careful about the promises and commitments we ask for. Really, in a sense, we need a right ordering of commitments within our covenantal relation with God. It's sort of an Augustinian notion. But I think a lot of people have a nagging sense of responsibility, that they should be doing more. But they're working with a very unwieldy and unhelpful notion of what it is they should be doing. So a renewed emphasis on what's important or really important and what our fundamental commitments are could actually be very freeing. Not binding, but freeing, to begin to talk about what are the most fundamental, most important commitments in our lives. I think also we want to be more careful and attentive to what we were talking about before, which is implicit promises. Are there assumptions that haven't been spelled out that leave certain members of a staff or a group vulnerable for failing to do things they didn't know they were supposed to be doing? Okay, and again, this is particularly likely in cross-cultural kinds of ministries, you know, where the assumptions are just different based on what your own background is. It seems to me that it's in the area of implicit promises that we're most likely to run into difficulty, especially on staff teams and working with volunteers and so on, just because things aren't spelled out and people might have different expectations without even realizing it. So there's different cultures, different assumptions. And that's true particularly in times of transition, where you're taking in new leadership or something like that, or again, where you're working cross-culturally. When people are incorporating new people, new leadership, it's really helpful to be more explicit about expectations and commitments. It is undoubtedly easier to spell this out at the front end than to have to deal with it after the difficulties have arisen. Not that you want to like have a whole set of binding rules or something or other, but just to set up environments in which you can talk about the expectations and begin to get some of that out there, I think can be very helpful. Promising and fidelity involve honoring both commitments and boundaries. Where especially lead pastors have a responsibility to preserve and protect the integrity of their team members. I had a student who told me about a situation that was very, very deeply disturbing. He was doing his supervised ministry or whatever it was, or he was on the staff of a church where the senior pastor was simply unable to say no to any request. Simply didn't say no. And so he always agreed to do what the person asked. And then he would pass it on to an already overworked staff and say, I'm sorry, I know I shouldn't have done this, but could you take care of it? Mm. And I think his need to be liked and kind of affirmed meant that he was not honoring the integrity and needs of his own staff people. And I think that can be a problem where we also need to honor the integrity of the persons with whom we work. I think we do want to find ways to honor and celebrate acts and lives of fidelity. We don't see it that often. When we do see it, it should be something that's celebrated. We mostly notice this absence. We notice when relationships and stuff fail. What we don't notice is when there's long faithfulness over a long period. Because what gets celebrated does get repeated. And so small acts of fidelity or long acts of fidelity, presence and promise keeping add up to a way of life that's powerful and holy and winsome. Sometimes people just coming every week and opening up the doors of the church and cleaning up or just showing up are acts of simple faithfulness that allow the bigger, more dramatic things to happen. But sometimes there are also very costly expressions of faithfulness, and it's important to respect and honor those who have made sacrifices. So recognizing the costliness sometimes of fidelity. And I think associated with that is being careful about how we interpret sacrifice. In this culture, anyway, I think self-sacrifice, well, I think generally self-sacrifice is about faithfulness in the hard places, right? It's being faithful in the hard places. I think in this culture, that's often seen as dysfunctional. It's like you're sacrificing yourself and so on. Sometimes faithfulness in keeping promises is profoundly costly. And, you know, if you think about caring for elderly parents who need more and more care, or caring for a child with severe disabilities and so on, that can have an impact on the caregiver's health, on their career, on their ability to volunteer, on relationships, and so on. And I think recognizing this as an act of faithfulness is something that we need to do as congregations. I mean, I think sometimes when people are really kind of burdened by the kinds of work that's required to stay faithful in those situations, sometimes the best congregation members can do is say, you know, you really need better boundaries, or you ought to take a rest. And it's like, that is really not a very helpful response to the situation. Coming alongside people and helping them to stay faithful in those situations and recognizing the cost and the goodness of what they're doing is really important.
That's a good word.
Yes.
Yeah, it's challenging because I think culturally we have this whole sort of script that says it's really about, you know, self-actualization and fulfillment and so on, and yet those kind of acts of faithfulness can be hard and not extremely fulfilling at the moment anyway. They can be very costly.
And often done in secret.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, you're not calling attention to it usually. So we do need to recognize that promise making and keeping can be messy when there are competing claims. Sometimes we really struggle to know how to acknowledge responsibility. Sometimes it's not clear to whom we should be faithful. And sometimes you can have very strange conflicts when subgroups demand loyalty, but the subgroup ends up operating at odds with the well-being of the larger group. And you sort of traffic in misplaced fidelity. That can be very difficult in congregations. In fact, Jean Vanier, who's written wonderful material on community, says the community is endangered both by enemies and friends. And I think there are times when that's true, where friends can sort of traffic in misplaced fidelity, and they can sort of demand loyalty as a subgroup at the expense of the larger community, when they sort of form many communities. But in writing about healthy communities, Vanier observed that, he says in Community and Growth, he says, the essential nourishment of communities is fidelity to the 1,001 demands of each day. Which I think is a very interesting claim, that promise keeping and fidelity are fundamentally nourishing. They're not first hard and sacrificing and so on. Basically, they're nourishing. In the end, though, it's only about the power of the Holy Spirit and the grace of God that allows us to keep the promises we make and the commitments we make, especially in the hard places. But again, we can rely on the fact that we know that God is faithful and true and will be with us.